Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive. NeedMoreRoasters.com. From WFIU, I'm Kate Young, and this is Earth Eats. On today's show, we're giving a second listen to an exploration of research on food pairing and flavor networks. Earth Eats associate producer Alex Chambers walks us through the work of Dr. Yang Yoel An. He goes by YY. Dr. An is a professor of informatics and computing at Indiana University and co-creator of a fascinating map of flavor networks. Harvest Public Media has a story about how fake meat is becoming so realistic the meat industry wants tighter labeling laws. Chef Daniel Orr has ideas for grape leaves, and Susan Mintert has a quick take on making caramel popcorn. That's all just ahead on Earth Eats. If plant-based meat sounds like an oxymoron, you're not alone. But major changes in the meat industry are forcing producers, consumers, and regulators to rethink the nature of meat. In the not-so-distant future, some companies hope to produce meat on an industrial scale without ever slaughtering animals. In the first of two stories for Harvest Public Media, Frank Morris reports that the first challenge is regulating plant-based products that taste, look, and feel a lot like meat.
Veggie burgers used to attract a niche market, but Savannah Blevins, server at this old neighborhood bar and grill in Kansas City, Missouri, called Charlie Hooper's, says meatless burgers are catching on, even here.
Does anybody ever order this Impossible Burger?
Oh yeah, all the time. It's a vegetarian burger, but people, I had a vegetarian actually turn it away because it reminded them so much of meat, they sent it back. But yeah, it's delicious.
Really?
The industry producing plant-based meat is exploding, growing 20% a year.
The business is booming. Yeah, we just can't keep up. We're actually having to expand our production facilities to keep up with the demand that's out there for this type of food.
That's Todd Boyman, co-founder of Hungry Planet, which makes vegetarian products that mimic beef and chicken. It primarily uses soy protein. Others use pea protein combined with other ingredients to make food that looks and tastes a lot more meaty than, say, tofu dogs or black bean burgers.
When you look at how conventional meat is produced, it's plant protein going through a cow, a chicken, a pig, et cetera, and getting turned into a different form. All of us in this category, we're doing the same thing, but we're doing it without the services of animals.
Which also cuts way down on greenhouse gas emissions and water use. Now, the plant-based meat sector is still tiny, less than $1 billion a year in sales. The U.S. animal protein business is more than 200 times larger. Jessica Almy with the Good Food Institute says there's lots of room for growth.
I think there's an enormous opportunity for growth with plant-based food products, particularly plant-based meats. A good example is to look at how plant-based milks are doing.
You can see it in the dairy case in this grocery store in the middle of Kansas City. There are at least four kinds of almond milk, soy milk, coconut milk, pea milk. Almy says plant-based milk has captured 13% of the liquid milk market in the United States. But where she sees opportunity, others see peril.
My name is Danielle Beck, and I'm Senior Director of Government Affairs for the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
Beck argues that lax regulation has helped plant-based milk get a foothold in the dairy section.
Soy milk and almond milk under the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act are legally misbranded.
Milk does have a legal standard of identity in the U.S. The default is it comes from a cow. And Beck argues that the very word milk carries nutritional expectations that plant-based products don't.
At the end of the day, words have meaning, and product labels need to provide consumers with enough information to make informed purchasing decisions.
The FDA is revisiting its requirements for plant-based milk labels. Meanwhile, the livestock industry is lobbying hard to stop plant-based meats from gaining the same foothold. It promoted a new law in Missouri that forbids misrepresenting a product not derived from a dead animal as meat.
So we've sued the state of Missouri over this law because we think it's vague.
It's Jessica Almy again. She says the law fails to spell out just how a food expressly designed to taste like beef, chicken, or sausage can be labeled. She says nobody's confused about the origin of something like almond milk. Almy says other states will probably try to replicate Missouri's label law, forcing court fights across the country. But this fuss over plant-based meat substitutes is only a warm-up to a much bigger fight looming. That's coming in likely a decade or less, when actual animal meat produced without slaughtering animals, that is, meat grown entirely in laboratories, could reach grocers' shelves. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Frank Morris.
This story originally aired on NPR. For more stories from this reporter collective, visit harvestpublicmedia.org. I know it's the middle of winter, but with the solstice behind us and the light returning, we can begin to look towards spring. Make a note, you want to start looking for grape leaves in the early spring when they're nice and tender, and then you can preserve them to make dolmas and other interesting dishes. Chef Daniel Orr tells us how.
Fresh grape leaves, you really need to pick when they're young, still tender, nice and green, very vibrant colored, and you want to get nice big ones because you're going to be stuffing them. You can use any kind of grape leaves. Wild grape leaves tend to be a little smaller, but you can use them. And if you use those, what I'll do is I'll take two or three of those leaves to roll one dolma because they are smaller. You wash them well, and then you blanch them and shock them. Again, blanching is cooking them quickly in heavily salted water. Shocking is dropping them in an ice water bath. Then we're going to lay them out, and we're going to stack them. And there are lots of different things you can do with these. You can stuff them with a hot stuffing, such as a kind of a sausage and rice stuffing. Then roll them up and then bake them in a sauce. You can fill them with rice and then steam them and serve them cold. I also like to fill them with risotto and mozzarella cheese and then bake them in a tomato sauce. So lots of different things you can do. You can even wrap them around fish like a salmon or even fresh sardines and then put them on the grill. You need to have about 40 or 50 of these to fill a jar. And once you have them stacked, you're gonna fold them up. Now they're still really tough at this point, so they wouldn't really be that enjoyable to eat. So the canning process is one of the things that makes them palatable. What you do is you fold these up from the sides, almost like you're making a burrito, and you make little packages like that, and then you put them in your canning jars, then you fill it up with water that's salted to the point it'd be almost like ocean water, and then you're going to put a fair amount of lemon juice. You need a quarter cup of lemon juice or a half teaspoon of citric acid per jar. And that is what's going to really make them tender and also give them a lot of flavor.
Find this recipe and instructions for canning your grape leaves at eartheats.org.
Hey, Kate.
Hey, Alex.
So I've got a story for you. It's about food and flavors and how to put those together.
So food pairings?
Yeah. And it's also about data, how we collect data about what we like to eat. It's kind of a cautionary tale.
So you're saying it's a food pairing parable?
You could say that. It starts with an image.
Let's have it.
So I've got this graphic in front of me, and it looks a little like the map of your airline's flight routes in the back of the in-flight magazine. But instead of the big hubs being Atlanta and Chicago, they're roast beef, black tea, and beer. And there's no Pacific Northwest or Florida. Instead of regions of the country, there are fruits, vegetables, alcoholic beverages, spices, meats. It's kind of beautiful. Each category of food has a different color, and there are these circles of different sizes that show how popular each ingredient is, and they're connected by lines of different thicknesses. Those lines are the key, what the graphic is about. But before I get to that, I want to say that the researchers who created this graphic used it to give us new insights into how global cuisines relate to each other and don't relate. Insights that have been written up in the Washington Post and Scientific American and even NPR, and which may not be accurate at all. So how did all this get started?
I was just sitting in the same office with one of my colleagues, and he's really interested in food.
This is YY An, one of the researchers.
I'm an assistant professor at Department of Informatics.
At Indiana University. He spoke with Earth Eats producers Lee Bush.
I'm Lee.
And Maddie Chara.
And I'm Maddie.
Last December. So, his office mate
went to some seminar by colleagues, a physicist colleague. And this colleague studies like food science in a like physics way.
And he comes back to the office after this seminar and starts telling YY about the food pairing hypothesis.
The idea is basically, okay, if you have two food ingredients that share some flavor compounds, if you mix them, they'll taste better.
The idea has gotten a lot of traction lately. Chefs are using it to come up with new dishes, and there's even a website, foodpairing.com, where if you subscribe, you can use their scientific method to identify which foods and drinks go well together.
My friend, my office mate, when he heard about that idea, he immediately realized that it's about networks, because you're talking about ingredients, sharing compounds, so you're making connections between ingredients. So that's essentially network.
Whoa. So that's how your flavor network project was born,
yeah,
basically?
Yeah. So right after the seminar, he apparently rushed to the library, sit there for a week, typed a whole book that lists like flavor compound and ingredients.
And that's what the graphic is all about. Each of the ingredients is represented by a circle. The size of the circle shows how common the ingredient is. Ingredients are linked up with other ingredients by lines of different thicknesses that show how many flavor compounds those ingredients share. You might not be surprised that beef and pork share a lot of flavor compounds. But it's interesting to note that garlic, which is super popular, hardly shares flavors with any other ingredients, whereas beer, while not popular as an ingredient, seems to be at the center of everything, flavor-wise. Anyway, YY and Sebastian didn't want to just stop at this beautiful rendition of the flavor network. They wanted to test the flavor pairing hypothesis itself. Do dishes taste better when their ingredients share flavor compounds?
People made these nice dishes and nice combinations, new combinations of food using this food pairing hypothesis. But nobody really kind of systematically studied that.
To answer, you need to know what people actually cook.
I was kind of chatting in the office, and I thought that maybe we can use recipes to kind of test the hypothesis.
And even though immediately after Sebastian heard about the flavor hypothesis,
he apparently rushed to the library, typed a whole book.
It's not like they were going to type out thousands of cookbooks worth of recipes. They got their data the way most of us do when we need to look something up. They went online.
We used two recipe databases, which are kind of in English and fairly large. These are epicurious.com and
one of my favorites.
Yeah.
allrecipes.com. But then these are all American websites. Mm-hmm. So I chose one Korean recipe website called menupan.com.
And how many recipes did that end up being?
It's about 56,000 recipes total.
And they grouped the recipes into geographically distinct cuisines. North American, Western European, Southern European, Latin American, and East Asian, based on how they were tagged on the website.
So what were some of the things that came out of this project? What did you find?
Well, I think the most interesting thing was there's a huge variance across culture. So I mean, the initial idea was, can we test this hypothesis of food pairing, right? Mm-hmm.
That flavor compounds make ingredient combinations that will appear more frequently in recipes because they share similar flavors.
Right. So they crunched some numbers.
Wow, Alex, is that actually the sound of numbers being crunched?
No, that's chips. I figure they've got to munch on something while they do their math.
Oh. Well, what did they find? Did the theory hold?
It seems to hold in North American and Western European recipes.
Interesting.
But
get ready for
the
it.
The opposite holds for like East Asian recipes.
In other words, in North American and Western European recipes, the more flavor compounds are shared by two ingredients, the more likely they appear together in recipes. But in East Asian cuisine, the more flavor compounds two ingredients share, the less likely they're used together. This is the part where I started to get excited. Data science was revealing something about cultural practice that we hadn't been able to see because it needed to be quantified first. And I'm not the only one who found this exciting. This is the result that made its way into the magazines and newspapers, including the MIT Technology Review, which says that these recipe networks give the lie to the idea that ingredients that share flavors taste better together. But do they? It turns out, after all that fanfare, that's not quite what the report says. I'll explain after the break.
Production support comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. And Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeigner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington.
So we left off with the conclusion that different cuisines approach taste in really different ways. Some like to overlap and blend flavors, while others like to contrast them. If you care about making things taste good, this is worth knowing. But if you're really curious, you start to look at what the ingredients are, and things suddenly get a lot murkier. The thing is, these conclusions are based on the prevalence of six characteristic ingredients in each of the cuisines. In East Asian, it's soy sauce, scallion, sesame oil, rice, ginger, and soybean. Not too surprising, right? Now listen to the six most authentic North American ingredients. Butter. Egg. Wheat. Milk. Vanilla. Cane molasses. Think about that North American list. Of all the possibilities, doesn't it seem strange that vanilla is in the top six? What do you use vanilla for? Especially in combination with eggs, flour, milk, and something called cane molasses. Baked goods. Dessert. And dessert got me thinking about data. The data that YY and Sebastian used suggests that baked goods are the most popular part of the North American diet, the thing North Americans eat more than anything else. But as much as we like our cakes, that kind of didn't seem right. So I asked Maddie Chara, one of the food anthropologists who interviewed YY, why there might be so many recipes for baked goods. She said the websites don't necessarily reflect what we actually cook.
I know I don't bake cakes, you know, even once a month, as much as I enjoy cakes. However, I think that when I do bake a cake, partially because baking is so precise, I usually tend to use a recipe. And I think also that there's a bit of entertainment value in recipes for things like baked goods and desserts. So it's maybe not as fun to read about. I think I was thinking of vegan nut loaf, which would be a pretty complex thing to make and not many people know about it. But probably you're only looking up a recipe for that if you're actually going to make it.
Whereas
people enjoy reading or looking at recipes for sort of fun celebratory foods like cakes, cookies, other desserts, even if they're not going to actually make them. So there might be more of those recipes out there, and it's not necessarily a reflection of how frequently they're consumed in the diet.
And if the websites don't reflect what we eat, then YY's datasets might not be saying what we think they're saying and what we want them to be saying, like that these two cuisines are different. One matches flavors and one contrasts them. The data might not be telling us that, which was a bummer because I liked the idea that East Asian cuisine was doing something different with flavor than North American. But if the proof wasn't in the online pudding recipe, maybe I could find someone who'd tasted the pudding. Luckily, I had a food anthropologist on hand.
I think that even if the data is imperfect, there might be some truth there based on my ethnographic experience, which was in southern India. And from what I know from reading and observing and talking to people there, there is a high value placed on having lots of different contrasting flavors within a meal and even within a dish.
Which, in southern India at least, has to do with the influence of the Ayurvedic tradition, where there are six different flavors and
those present in the dish or the meal creates a sense of balance.
There's a reason YY's point about cuisines was so exciting. It felt right. And Maddie Chara's on-the-ground research says it might hold water after all. Trying to figure this story out reminded me that the information we collect about people is never neutral. It's always from a perspective, and it doesn't necessarily reflect what people are actually doing, because it doesn't capture everything about their lives. Which is why, if you're into crunching numbers, it can be good to have an anthropologist around.
Just talking to people, getting life histories, interviewing them, spending a lot of time with a certain cultural community and really learning more about their daily practices and what kind of flavors they put together.
To help figure out how people might be making the data and using it in their daily lives. To check your bird's eye view. For YY, though, I might be missing the point. The goal of the study wasn't to prove something beyond a doubt. We would need a better understanding of people's actual practices to do that.
Yeah, so I think the important meaning of this research is we have data, and we can use data sets to study like cuisines and food culture. And I think that's a big milestone that we can pass. So it's not like really, how to say, showing like really strong result. It's more like, oh, maybe this is possible. And why don't you come over and have fun and enjoy looking into this amazing data set about food culture.
So come on over. We've got the Flavor Network on our website. Like I said, it's kind of beautiful.
If you're looking for a fun treat to take to a party, give as gifts, or to enjoy with family and friends over the winter holidays, homemade caramel corn is always a hit. Susan Mintert of the Indiana Home Cooks podcast uses a paper grocery bag and the microwave oven to crank out this addictive snack in minutes. You'll start with popped popcorn in a large brown paper bag, and then you'll make the caramel sauce. I'll let Susan and her daughter Christine tell you how it's done.
What we have in here is a cup of brown sugar. We've got a half cup of butter, unsalted butter, a quarter cup of corn syrup, and a half teaspoon of salt. We've also measured out a half teaspoon of baking soda and put it aside because we will add it a little later. We're going to start, though, this mixture in the microwave oven, and we're going to give it 2 minutes to start now. Okay, so our mixture has cooked for 2 minutes. Our butter is melted and bubbly, and we're going to give this a stir. And by the way, I just use a large measuring cup. I have a 4-cup Pyrex measuring cup, and this is just the perfect size for this recipe. Now, we've got that stirred, so this is going to go in for 2 more minutes, and then the very last thing will be the baking soda. Yeah, we've got about 1 more minute in the microwave for our caramel, and it has bubbled up almost to the top of this 4-cup measuring cup. So this is just the right size. And when it's done, we'll pull it out and we'll add our soda and give it a final stir. All right, it's all done, and we will carefully bring it out. So we're going to put on our soda, give it one more stir, and it's going to foam up. Just incorporate that thoroughly, Christine. Scrape it around the sides there, and then give it a real good mix in. Looks lovely. So now we're going to come back over here to where our popcorn is in the bag, and could you hold that?
Yep.
All right. And we are going to pour the caramel right onto the corn in the bag. So stand clear to make sure we get as much of it as we can on the corn. There we have it. Okay. And now we're going to just... What we do at this point is we fold and seal the bag closed. So fold it down about 3 times and crease it so that it stays securely closed. And then just hold it firmly and you shake the bag vigorously. Shake it from side to side, turn it over, shake it some more. You're trying to distribute the caramel throughout the popped corn. So after about 30 seconds of vigorous shaking, we make sure the bag is tightly sealed, and then we put it in the microwave oven. And it's a series of 4 cooking segments, each followed by more shaking, until... Okay. I just take my offset spatula, or just any kind of a spatula, and you can spread it out and let it cool. And as soon as it's cool enough to eat, you can start eating it.
Yep.
So there it is. It's still quite warm. You can feel the heat coming off of it. But in just a few minutes, it's going to be cooled and crispy, and it's just got a really lovely coating on it, and it's delicious.
Susan Mintert is the host of the Indiana Home Cooks podcast. The complete recipe for caramel corn in a bag is at indianahomecooks.com and at eartheats.org. Production support comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world, offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com. Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. And The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. Thank you to all of the folks who make our show possible, including Aya Bonbinder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, and all the folks at Farm Bloomington Restaurant, the IU Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to YY On, Susan Mintert, Maddie Chera, and Lee Bush. Earth Eats theme music is composed by Aaron Toby and performed by Aaron and Matt Toby. Our executive producer is John Bailey. I'm Kate Young. Thanks for listening to Earth Eats, and we'll see you next week.